Okay, so 1997 was the year I began my PhD here at Warwick, and my plan was to study gendered employment practices in export-oriented multinational firms in Malaysia. Having written my beautiful proposal to the ESRC, the Asian crisis hit, and I wondered, would there be anything for me to study at all? Would there be any factories left in Asia for me to go and study their gendered recruitment practices? And of course, this was not the case at all. And by the time I embarked on my field work in 1999, the factory managers that I interviewed told me how the crisis had been great for business, since the devalued ringgit had given them a competitive edge in European and North American markets. And the major problem they foresaw was that of labour shortage, which they felt could be easily resolved through the importation of migrant labour from neighbouring Indonesia. So famously, in 1997, Malaysia had eschewed international financial institutions and had imposed currency controls. Malaysia was not regarded as having experienced economic crisis in the same way as states such as Thailand or Indonesia, and the blossoming of a reformasi movement in 98-99 following the arrest of the then Malaysian Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim on sodomy and corruption charges did not lead to a greater democratisation of the country's political system. Elsewhere in the regions, the effects of the crisis were much more obvious. We see the IMF-imposed reform packages hitting Thailand and Indonesia and the undermining of Suharto's grip on power in Indonesia. So as many of you are probably aware, the impact of the crisis on Southeast Asia is mixed. But more importantly, it seems to be the case that no matter how intensely the crisis was felt or how severe the popular or political backlash to the crisis or the crisis-imposed austerity measures were, no Southeast Asian country moved decisively to change the kind of pro-globalisation development strategies that they'd been fostering since at least the 1980s. So one of the things I want to talk about in this brief presentation is, well, does 1997 actually matter for those of us engaged in the study of Southeast Asian political economy? From the point of view, for me, as someone engaged in a study of Malaysia's political economy, it's very difficult to sustain the view that... Oh, my text is going all over the place. Sustain the view that 1997 led to a really significant shift in the country's economic policy direction, and the dismantling of more statist forms of economic governance had begun at least as far back as the 1980s, mainly in reaction to an economic slowdown that had hit the country's key export sector, electronics, at the time. So things like very draconian industrial relations reforms, liberalisation of the foreign direct investment regimes, privatisation programmes, etc., they have their roots more in the 1980s than as some sort of response to 1997. The imposition of currency controls and selective support for major corporations following the 1997 crisis by the state also, you know, although these things did take place, there's not any kind of significant slowing down in a commitment to pro-globalisation economic reforms. And indeed, after 1997, and there's a continued commitment to relaxing rules around foreign direct investment and finance. So does 1997 matter? Well, for me, as someone engaged in the study of Southeast Asian political economy, I think 1997 matters, but not for the reasons you might think. I think 1997 matters because of its impact on the academic study of Southeast Asian political economy. So in their attempts to understand the crisis, we see the emergence of a very important body of scholarship. And this scholarship contends that the 1997 crisis should not be portrayed as a turning point in Southeast Asian political economy, so it shouldn't be seen as a turning point, and it shouldn't be seen as a kind of cataclysmic event that signaled the end of developmental forms of state government. It asks, also raises questions about whether the capitalist economies of Southeast Asia were ever really developmental states at all. Many Southeast Asian states have long been involved in forms of economic management that rested on finding a balance between vested statist interests revolving around, say, the military or privileged ethnic groups, and more capitalist and globally oriented interests. In 1998, when I was kind of preparing for this presentation, I was looking at some of the literature that's come out from Southeast Asian political economists since 1997, and I came across a special issue from 1998 of the journal World Development. And it provided some good initial reflections on the impact of the crisis. It has contributions from people such as Ha-Joon Chan, Robert Wade, K.S. Jomo, Richard Robeson and Andrew Rosser, amongst others. And this special issue, I think, provides insights into the way in which political economists have critically intervened in debates, particularly in terms of how we think and theorise the role of the state in Southeast Asian political economy. So the Malaysian economist K.S. Jono, he, for example, highlights how the immediate causes of the crisis can be seen in the liberalisation of finance regimes across the region. But then he goes on to make some broader claims, which I think are perhaps more important, writing that the recent currency and financial crisis in Southeast Asia suggests that the Southeast Asian miracle has been built on some shaky grounds. And he points to the origin of the crisis in Malaysia, in the emergence of a two-tier economy divided between foreign-owned finance and increasingly foreign-employing production enclaves, and a domestic economy where much of the retained wealth and retained wealth generated was captured by business cronies of those in power. Richard Robeson and Andrew Rosser, in the same issue, make similar claims, pointing to the origins of Indonesia's crisis in the 1980s, with a shift that took place away from state managers to private interests, resulting in the emergence of powerful coalitions between private business interests and political and bureaucratic power holders. And these writings, I'd suggest, signal the start of an important body of literature on Southeast Asian political economy that doesn't deny that after 1997 there was a speeding up or a renewed commitment to neoliberal-style economic reform, but stresses both stresses, in a sense, the longer origins of this shift in the very constitution of Southeast Asian forms of state developmentalism. So it presents the state as performing a regulatory, so a more kind of managerialist or neoliberal compatible function rather than a developmental function. And more importantly, this literature places an important emphasis on the tensions and resistances that take shape between competing sections of elite classes as states embarked on programs of economic reform. So a great book in this tradition is a 2006 edited collection by Richard Robeson and Kevin Hewison called East Asia and the Trials of Neoliberalism. So I really like the emphasis on tensions and resistances that both drive and inhibit economic reform, and the centrality ascribed to the state in this literature, and it's a framework that I've employed to a certain extent in my own work on gender and economic policy making in Malaysia. But I also think that what we're seeing now in studies of Southeast Asia is an important shift, a move away from looking at neoliberal reform in relation to competing elite statist interests. And there's an emerging highly interdisciplinary literature that emphasises the way in which processes of commodification or market building take place within everyday social practices. Now, I'm not suggesting here that we need to lose sight of the state in our analysis of Southeast Asian political economy. Rather, there's a need to explore how the economic transformation of the region takes shape at the very local level. So it could be... So one of the things that this literature does is to point to the way in which new market spaces are developing in the region, be it in things like live fish exports, halal certified products, new forms of tourism such as medical or ecotourism, or expanding markets for migrant domestic work. How long have I got?
5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes. So,
well, you've had your 10 minutes, so the 5 minutes.
Okay, so that's perfect. And also a kind of emphasis on the role that civil society actors are shown to frequently play in supporting the extension of markets into these more everyday spaces, for example, in terms of things like administering microfinance schemes or providing market-friendly forms of religious employee training to corporations or engaging in anti-corruption activities. So I want to provide an important illustrative example here from my own work on regimes of domestic labour migration in the Southeast Asian region. When the 1997 crisis hit Malaysia, alongside the currency controls, Mahathir, the then Prime Minister's peddling of conspiracies about Jewish bankers and a rash of jingoistic government advertising extolling citizens to be bullish on the economy, another measure that was taken was to stop accepting unskilled migrant workers. Nonetheless, given the continued economic dependency of the country on migrant workers, these workers were soon allowed back in. And year on year, the number of both documented and undocumented migrant workers employed in Malaysia has increased. At the same time, we see the state increasingly involved in crackdowns against undocumented workers. This includes large-scale deportations and sanctionings of things like volunteer police forces to enforce draconian immigration laws. For academic commentators on Malaysia, people like Christine Chin or Iwa Ong, these crackdowns are understood as a mechanism through which the state gains consent for wider programs of economic transformation, creating a kind of stigmatized other on which to pin a whole range of social ills. The stigmatization of non-national others is also a central component in the maintenance of the market for migrant domestic work, whereby Indonesian women in particular are constructed as simple rural girls, not deserving of the higher rates of pay commanded by other groups of workers or other groups of domestic workers as well. And the expanding market for migrant domestic work in Malaysia over the last decade has enabled middle-class women's participation in the formal economy and also performed an important role in signifying the attainment of middle-class status among Malaysia's new rich. And I'd say that we also need to think through the ways in which these kind of regulatory states in Southeast Asia have acted to foster the development of this market through hands-off forms of economic management, namely the signing of bilateral agreements that sanction the role of private employment brokerage agencies in both states to manage this flow of migrants. And ethnographic research into the return migration system provides some wonderful insights into how people are transformed into kind of good workers, good economic migrants. So I think this example is useful because we see that the return migration system shows how both an analysis of the regulatory function of the state doesn't need to be focused merely on the activities of elite actors, that we can gain particular insights into how Southeast Asian states function as political economic actors by focusing on the very everyday ways in which state activities impact on the lives of ordinary people, and in doing so reveal more than just mere instances of tension and resistance between ruling elites. We also create a space for thinking through how the practices of regulatory states are constituted through things like gendered, racialized, or classed sets of social relations. So that's the end of the presentation there. So broadly what I've done is to say, look, 1997 is a quite important turning point in terms of the consolidation of a body of literature on Southeast Asia, and you know that literature in itself is now becoming much more focused on a kind of everyday political economy of Southeast Asia and is less overtly concerned with kind of elite politics within particular nation states.
Thank you very much.